Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the 47th annual Battle of Alusty reenactment will be held February 15th through 18th.
My great-great-grandfather died on the battlefield here, and I came out here for many years. I've been out here about 18 years now, and for the first 10 years or so, I didn't know that.
We'll discuss the lynching of Arthur Henry.
On December the 6th, 2023, a dedication ceremony was conducted outside the Wellsbelt Museum in the Paramore neighborhood of Orlando for the installation of a historical marker remembering Arthur Henry.
And we'll visit the St. Augustine National Cemetery. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The loud booming of cannon fire rips through the North Florida pine forest 15 miles east of Lake City as startled cavalry horses whinny. Repeated rifle fire rings through the trees as more than 10,000 soldiers confront each other on February 20, 1864 near Ocean Pond. The Battle of Alusty was the largest conflict of the American Civil War fought on Florida soil. Each side began with about 5,000 troops. When the three-hour battle was over, nearly 3,000 soldiers were dead, two-thirds of them from the Union forces. Three new U.S. colored troop regiments bravely fought as Union soldiers at the Battle of Alusty, some even before they had an opportunity to complete their training. An annual reenactment of the bloody fight is held at the Alusty Battlefield Historic State Park. Sean Adams is Associate Professor of History at the University of Florida.
Alusty is important for a number of political reasons. It is significant because it comes at a time when the United States is attempting to swing southern states back into the Union. There was an attempt, for example, to reconstruct Louisiana in 1863. The notion is that you're going to also then swing Florida into the Union. So this is after also the Emancipation Proclamation had made it possible for African-American soldiers to serve. And so the combination of those factors, the presence of black soldiers, but also the idea of reconstructing Florida, create the impetus for this campaign to secure Florida. It comes out of the east going towards the west, and it kind of the Confederate and Union forces meet right here at Alusty. And so the significance of this battle is that what it does is it means that Florida is not going to be one of those kind of early states to be reconstructed. And the presence of black soldiers is significant not only in its meaning for African-American citizenship, but also in the unfortunate events that occurred at the end of the battle when many wounded black soldiers were summarily executed by Confederate troops.
The Union lost the Battle of Alusty, but won the Civil War 14 months later. Florida was the third state to secede from the Union in January 1861, behind only South Carolina and Mississippi. Sean Adams.
Florida was very significant to the Confederate war effort in that it supplied beef, it supplied salt. It was an area where supplies could come in. The United States sets up a blockade of the Confederate coast, but of course Florida has a massive coast. There's no way that those Union ships are going to be able to keep all activity away from Florida. Now, the one thing that's interesting and significant about Florida is that it had no rail connection with the South in the beginning of the war. And so there's an internal struggle within Florida to set up a kind of rail connection. Railroads were in many ways the lifelines for Civil War armies. And so without that lifeline, Florida's impact on the Confederate army could be limited. And so that's why that was in many ways so contested. And that's why control over the state was so contested, because the Confederacy was trying to run a war on, frankly, limited resources. And Florida beef and Florida salt were really, really significant parts of that kind of logistical aspect of the war.
The Alusty Battlefield Historic Site is Florida's first state park, established in 1909. Since 1977, an annual reenactment of the Battle of Alesti has been staged here. Gary Dickinson is president of the Alesti Battlefield Citizen Support Organization. The CSO is the not-for-profit group that presents the reenactment.
The CSO has a reenactment committee that's made up of every aspect out here, from the medical to the artillery to the sutlers to the State Park Service and the U.S. Forestry Service. We are blessed that we're able to have this on this and on actual battlefield because it's under the U.S. Forestry Service. We will start the planning phase immediately after this by looking at any problems that we had. We want to make sure those are straightened out for the next year to make sure it's an enjoyable experience. Typically, we're going to plan for about 2,000 reenactors to be out here. We will have this weekend 21 cannons. Those are full-size artillery pieces. We'll have between 50 and 75 mounted cavalry units. So we'll start talking about our logistical plans, changes that may need to be made to the camp area where the authentic Confederates are at, the authentic Union camps are at. We also have areas for modern campers. We also have areas for civilians to come in and camp. So we'll look at that. If there's any improvements that need to be made, we'll make them for next year. We look at our sutler area. We have probably the finest group of sutlers with Civil War era items for sale that exist. We have national companies that come in here. So you can show up here and you can buy everything to become a private to a general, or if you just like to be a lady at the tea or the ball, everything you need is right here.
Authentic Union and Confederate camps are part of the reenactment weekend, with small groups of people in Civil War era costumes sitting around campfires among hundreds of small canvas tents. Food vendors are on hand nearby, along with informational displays and people selling Civil War memorabilia. A variety of public programs addressing various Civil War topics are presented, along with performances of period music. Joel Fears is a longtime participant in the Battle of Alesti annual reenactment weekend. Fears says he had graduated from college and was nearly an old man when he first discovered that African Americans were not just slaves, but actually fought and died in the Civil War. He wants to share this information with the public. Fears is dressed as a particular African American Union soldier.
I'm representing James Henry Gooding. He was one of the people who fought here. Again, they were all educated. He was also, he wrote dispatches to the New Bedford Mercury newspaper. And he also was writing a story of this battle. So he was a writer, well educated, but he was captured here in this battle. He was wounded. He was taken to Andersonville. He was imprisoned there and later on died there. If you go to Andersonville, to that historic site, you'll see a grave marker there with his name on it.
Mitch Morgan has been participating in the Battle of Alesti reenactment for nearly two decades, portraying a Confederate soldier. He explains that reenactors have an active weekend at the Alesti event.
Every year is a little bit different, but there's some similarities too. We're really pretty busy most of the time we're here, but it's what we enjoy doing. We go to colors every morning, up really early around 6 o'clock, they blow reveille. So you really don't have a lot of time for breakfast because you have to get some coffee down if you drink coffee and get on the line really early. We go down to colors. That's where we honor our ancestors and we raise the flags of both the Federal and Confederate camps. Listen to any announcers for the day. They remind us of what time the battle is. Then generally, such as today, we come back and try to grab something quick to eat because we go to a drill that lasts about an hour and a half. Then we get back from the drill, we have maybe another hour, hour and a half till we line up for the battle. So Saturdays are very, very busy. Sundays are a little bit better. We try to go to church on Sunday. We have a church service out here. We go to colors Sunday morning, come back, go to church, and battle again on Sunday. So it's a fairly busy weekend, but it's something that we enjoy.
Participating in the annual Battle of Alesti reenactment has special meaning for Morgan.
My great-great-grandfather died on the battlefield here, and I came out here for many years. I've been out here about 18 years now, and for the first 10 years or so, I didn't know that until I got interested in my genealogy and family history. And I'd always got kind of one of those feelings here that there was something more to this than just being in Florida's biggest battle, and I'm a native Floridian, but I said something more going on. I found out through my research that my great-great-grandfather died right here. He was the first unit to step on the field the day of the battle and perished. And I don't know where he's buried, possibly right where we're standing somewhere, because they're buried all over the area here. So it's real personal for me now, even more so because of having an ancestor here.
While the thousands of people who participate in the annual Battle of Alusti reenactment do so on a voluntary basis, not all of the soldiers who took part in the actual battle were so fortunate. Historian Sean Adams.
The Confederacy is actually the first in among the Union and the Confederacy to set up conscription. They do so pretty early. There's an initial wave of volunteerism, but then as the Confederacy runs low on potential troops, they enact a draft, they enact a conscription. And of course, the most controversial part of that draft was the idea that you could buy a substitute, which many people considered unpatriotic, but the idea was that you could, if you got drafted, you could basically pay someone to serve in your stead. And so some historians, it's a little bit contested, but some historians have argued that actually the bulk of this war and the bulk of the armies in both the Union and the Confederacy were willing to fight.
At least one set of conflicting viewpoints survives from the American Civil War. There is still disagreement over what exactly the war was all about. The Confederate view is that the war was about states' rights versus federal rights, while the Union perspective is that the war was fought because the South wanted to maintain slavery.
Famously, the Immigration Service, if you ask whether the Civil War is about slavery or states' rights, apparently both answers are correct. So it's tough. You know, you get asked to answer that question, and you're supposed to provide a really brief answer. I would say it's complicated, but the bulk of it was really about the preservation of slavery.
The Alusti Battlefield Historic State Park is east of Lake City. The annual reenactment held there commemorates Florida's largest Civil War battle, which happened on February 20, 1864. The 47th annual Battle of Alusti reenactment will be held February 15th through 18th. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch archived episodes of our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, acts of violence in the Jim Crow South often faded from public discussion within days of their occurrence. As scholars have increased access to local newspapers and family histories, they find more evidence of lynchings than previously understood. Acknowledging the extent of lynching and the individuals whose lives were ended in this manner has become a part of community history.
On December 6, 2023, a dedication ceremony was conducted outside the Wellsbelt Museum in the Paramore neighborhood of Orlando for the installation of a historical marker remembering Arthur Henry, an African-American World War I veteran who was lynched on Thanksgiving night, 1925. On the night before the dedication, 41 members of the Henry family from across the country met at Shiloh Baptist Church to share stories of their family. I was privileged to attend both events, which were open to the public. Hearing Arthur Henry's story and listening to his family speak to the violence that surrounded African American life in Florida in the 1920s was central to the events. But there was also a sense of triumph, grace, and reconciliation that was inspiring. The Henry family, like many other families present at the events, had in their past a record of generations of struggle that defy understanding. But they also provided an uplifting saga of triumph over adversity. I'll start with the Arthur Henry story. In 1925, Arthur Henry was a newly married World War I veteran. He and his wife, sister, and mother moved to Paramore from the Lake City area to find work and perhaps to flee an area that had experienced 20 lynchings since the end of the Civil War. There were jobs in the Orange County citrus groves, and Henry may have viewed the area as a better alternative to the situation in Columbia County. On Thanksgiving evening, as the Henry family began their holiday dinner, gunfire broke out in Paramore. Around 9 p.m., two police officers came into the darkened Henry home without identifying themselves, and gunfire was exchanged between Henry and the officers. All three were wounded. Arthur Henry was taken into custody, but not arrested or charged with a crime. All three men were transported to the Orange County Hospital, where Mr. Henry was placed in the basement ward reserved for black patients. He was secured to the bed by leg irons. In the early hours of the following morning, three armed men entered the basement ward and removed Arthur Henry from the hospital. 12 days later, his decomposing body was found in the Conway area, 8 miles from downtown Orlando. The coroner's jury determined that he died at the hands of, quote, persons unknown, end quote. Dr. Monroe Wells, a local black physician, signed his death certificate, and Edward Stone, a local black mortician, prepared his body for burial, just as he had done for July Perry 5 years earlier. Arthur Henry's body was returned to Columbia County, but it is unclear where he was buried. There is no gravestone for Arthur Henry, and as the family explained, the circumstances of his death were not passed to later generations of Henrys. Silence on the lynchings or other violence against African Americans was often maintained in black families of that generation. They hoped that such silences might protect children against a similar fate. Adding to the silence on Arthur Henry's death was the fact that he and his wife had no children, no direct descendants to remember what happened that night. But the story was there, and in time it would reemerge, and Arthur Henry would be remembered.
Connie, bringing Arthur Henry's story to light must have been extraordinarily difficult.
The vehicle for remembrance was located hundreds of miles north of Orlando, the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. The Equal Justice Initiative, or EJI, established by acclaimed public interest attorney Brian Stevenson to advocate for criminal justice reform, also created the Legacy Museum, From Enslavement to Mass Incarceration, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which, as their website proclaims, as part of their national effort to create new spaces, markers, and memorials that address the legacy of slavery, lynching, and racial segregation. EJI is committed to placing historic markers in communities where lynchings occurred. The Orange County Alliance for Truth and Justice, an affiliate of EJI, was responsible for initiating the action that brought the county its first marker honoring July Perry in 2019. Harry Coverston, one of the founding members of ATJ, took the initiative to research Arthur Henry's life and the 1925 lynching. He also dedicated his time to locating members of the larger Henry family. His work took 5 years to complete. In 2023, he and fellow ATJ member Valeda Fluellen met with members of the Henry family via Zoom, the first of several such meetings. As they soon discovered, the Henry family was remarkable in so many ways. The current members of the Henry family, descendants of Arthur Henry's aunts, uncles, and cousins, knew of Arthur Henry but did not know that he had been lynched. It is hard to imagine how a family absorbs such information, but they embraced the effort to remember their cousin. As plans unfolded to dedicate the marker, they made plans to be there, and 41 of them did arrive for the event. Their family history is remarkable. They thrived by leaving Columbia County, some migrating to the Florida coast, some to other parts of the South, and some outside the region. 8 members of the family hold doctorates. One member is Derrick Henry, the current mayor of Daytona Beach. They brought their children to the storytelling and dedication to be sure that the story of Arthur Henry would not be forgotten again in succeeding generations. As they told their stories, listened to the history Harry Coverston had uncovered, and participated in the dedication ceremony, everyone present at the events was struck by the courage and grace on display. One seldom has the opportunity to be a witness to such strength and humanity in a single person, But to see it in evidence in 41 members of a family is simultaneously uplifting and humbling. Arthur Henry has been restored to his family and to the community.
What an important story. And of course, Florida had more lynchings per capita than any other state in the Jim Crow South, including Arthur Henry. Thanks for sharing this story, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this look at an immersive experience for teachers at St. Augustine National Cemetery.
If you recall from my previous segment, UCF VOP Institute was a 10-day educational program hosted by the UCF Department of History's Veterans Legacy Program to teach veterans history to K-12 educators across Florida to honor and memorialize veterans buried in Florida's national cemeteries. Despite this context, the actual participants, the K-12 educators, were solemnly mentioned. Therefore, in this segment, I'll foreground the voices of the teachers, specifically Alexis Wood, a 4th grade elementary school teacher in Orange County, Florida. To get a sense of the climactic moment and emotions in the specific conversation I'm about to share, I must further elucidate two significant developments leading up to this moment. One, the task assigned to the teachers to complete the objective of the Institute, and two, the time and place of the climax in the Institute. For starters, the climax of the Institute was a meta field trip to the St. Augustine National Cemetery, where all the veterans assigned to the teachers are interred. The prefix meta signifies the pedagogical component and, by extension, the primary purpose of this exercise, to show how to conduct a field trip to a national cemetery for K-12 students. The teachers occupied a dual role in this enterprise. Rather than being just passive receivers of the action, they were also challenged by the UCF VOP team to actively engage with the pedagogy behind constructing such an experience for students. Being both recipients and participants of this field trip empowers them to be exceptional tour guides when they take their students to a national cemetery because they've experienced both sides of that pedagogical coin, student and teacher. This field trip beautifully synthesized the three deliverables the K-12 teachers were assigned during the Institute. The three deliverables were the following. A. Research the life of a World War II veteran who died in service during the war and is interred at St. Augustine National Cemetery. Use that biography as a model when teaching students how to complete their veteran bio. B. Construct a mini tour of St. Augustine National Cemetery. The teachers created tours based on several themes, including women, African Americans, and conflicts such as the Seminole Wars, the Civil War, and the World Wars. C. A lesson plan that fits their subject area, grade, and curriculum. In all lessons, the UCF VOP educators incorporated the experiences of individual veterans within the context of American history, while adhering to Florida State curriculum standards. And they are available for any teacher to use. So, if you are a teacher, or know a teacher, you can look at the lesson plans on the UCF VOP website, vop.ca.ucf.edu. This leads me to the final development, time and place. The field trip occurred on day 8 out of 10 of the Institute, meaning the K-12 teachers had been intensely working on their veteran for over a week, and subsequently developed an immense ardor with them and the broader work of the Institute. In the conversation you're about to hear, Alexis Wood was rubbing the headstone of her veteran. Headstone rubbing is a method to preserve the inscriptions seen on graves by putting an interfacing paper over the headstone and using a special crayon to rub the inscriptions on the stone to the paper. Some headstones do not stand the test of time, thus, this is a beautiful way to preserve headstones, and specifically for our K-12 teachers, a powerful and metamorphic exercise, as this gets them physically as close as possible to the human being they've been working on for 8 days. I'm here with Alexis Wood, who right now she's currently working on her veteran with the headstone, coloring it in. Just describe to me what you're feeling right now after being with this veteran for over a week.
I guess what's most surprising is I'm feeling very emotional.
Right.
It's a different type of connection than I've had thus far. It feels very real. And I hope that he's appreciating the presence and that I'm doing a good job on this. Hopefully.
I really do think he is appreciating this. This is one of the most wholesome moments, I think, of the Institute.
Yes. I didn't think, you know, I knew we were going to do this and I've never done it before. But I just didn't expect that I would feel so close to him in this moment. Like, everything's becoming real.
Right.
You know?
Right. And just talk to me about the technique of doing this so our listeners could really understand, since this is not a video podcast, unfortunately.
Yeah, so we're rubber banding this interfacing onto the gravestone, and then we're taking essentially a melted down crayon, and we're doing horizontal strokes kind of lightly. You just want to get some color on it. And because the names and all the information is recessed, it shows up as a contrast. So then you can really see everything that's on the headstone.
You think your students will enjoy this?
Oh my gosh, they would love this. I don't know if they would feel as emotional as I do right now, but I do think they would have so much fun with this. Anytime they can do something hands-on, it just makes it so much more meaningful for them to connect, makes the learning real. So I know they would just love to do this.
I know yesterday during our podcast conversation, you talked a little bit about your veteran, but what are some things that, I guess my question is, what are some of your favorite things about the veteran you work with, you're working with?
One of my favorite things was that he was in a science club in high school.
That's nice.
And I was too. So it definitely, we talked about that human aspect, and, you know, we're talking all about the negatives because, of course, they've passed. But just seeing them as who they were before they became a veteran, because that's important too, is to recognize that these are people with families, these are people with, they had interests and talents, and it wasn't just that they served. And unfortunately for mine, because he was so young, he didn't really get to show all of his talents to the world beyond the immense one that he ended up giving us. But it's just kind of fun to get to know him a little better.
100%. And now this is your guy, right?
This is my guy. He's mine now. Yeah, I claim him.
That's awesome. And it's those details that catch you by surprise, that they're so similar. Like, they have similar aspects to what you've done before.
Definitely. And I know mine was so young, he was 19. And I just wonder, you know, what would he have gone on to do if he did enjoy science? Would he have, you know, become a scientist or pursued it? He unfortunately didn't get a chance to have a wife and a family. But, you know, thinking about what his legacy could have been is interesting as well. Another new aspect to think about.
100%. Well, Alexis, thank you again for talking with me, and I'll let you finish and be with your veteran.
Thank you.
Next week, other teachers will reflect more broadly on their experiences at the 2023 UCF VOP Institute. If you are interested in participating in the 2024 UCF VOP Institute, or to learn more about UCF VOP, please contact Amelia Lyons at amelia.lyons@ucf.edu. To listen to my entire conversation with Alexis Wood, please subscribe to the UCF Department of History's podcast, Knight's History Cast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.